number one fan has just listened to the second time of Skylark of Space. Thank you so very much.
Go tape.
Hear now the words.
Greetings. I am Publius, and you, I suppose you know who you are listening to a long-form spoken word presentation on AnonRadio.net.
And it is Tuesday, the 23rd of July, in the glorious future year of 2024. And so our next two shows will be pre-recorded on account of this Friday I will be at Anime Fest, Saturday too, with a table display, and then Tuesday I am traveling, and although my air flight is not until 2 p.m., I do have to get there in advance anyway, and so I'll probably have to leave here around 10 a.m., which is when this show currently starts in my local time zone. And what do I have for you on those 2 days? Well, I have... Ed Strickland gave me CDs made from the audio tapes that he recorded at the first International Space Development Conference. And you've got people like Poul Anderson and Robert Heinlein talking. The quality of the tapes is not great, because he was using a battery-operated tape recorder, and the batteries were running down, and so the voice pitch keeps shifting upwards as the tape slows down. And so what I really need to do is edit that audio to apply a ramp on the timing, which is going to take some trial and error. Hello to Ingrix and Publi and Ingrix and Ratshue and Calm. Not to me. Why would I say hello to myself? Clearly, I am still a little out of it. I was so out of it yesterday. I went to get the jackets for number 2 of Blast printed, and I went to the wrong place. Yeah, I'm just doing great, folks. Anyway, Slide Rule is a small enough and light enough book that I think I will take it with me on my travel, and so you won't have to wait until October for the to finish it. Go. Metadata are now filled in, and we get back up here. I'll just start again with Chapter 8. Chapter 8. If I were starting a company like Airspeed over again, and had to begin again to look for risk capital, I should look first for individuals who had recently made a profit out of the sale of land. If I couldn't find them, I should probably abandon the job as hopeless. In such a quest, it is no good going to any organization such as a bank or an insurance company with large funds to invest, or even to a government office charged with the development of industry. Such organizations frequently think quite sincerely that they are putting out a portion of their resources in the form of risk capital, but their definition of a risk is different to mine. I never got any of them to touch airspeed. This is really quite interesting. In organizations such as that, some one official has to take the responsibility on his own shoulders for hazarding other people's money. If the money is lost, that official will have to stand up to some inquiry by the owners of the money and say, "I thought this was a good thing to do with your money, but it wasn't. I'm sorry, but it's lost." That official may be charged with the duty of laying out investments in risk capital, but in his own interest, he will always avoid the more wildcat schemes and will invest preferably in those which, in his view, present a reasonable prospect of security. In this way, he modifies and waters down his definition of the word risk to a meaning which others might class as development capital. No man who is responsible for other people's money will gamble with it to the extent required by genuine risk capital. One is minded of the parable of the talents in the gospel. To find risk capital, one must seek for the individual who has recently made a large profit in the nature of an unexpected windfall. Such a man, in general, will invest 95% of his profit prudently and safely, and he will gamble with the remaining 5% in the hope that this small investment will yield a great return and so increase the average income from his total holding. In my view, to find an investor of £1,000 in risk capital, one must seek for the individual who has recently made a profit or sold assets for £20,000 and has to do something with that money. Profits of that order may be made from the sale of a business, such as a shop or a chain of shops. Commercial people of that type, however, are not ready investors in genuine risk enterprises. Perhaps they know too much. Such profits are, however, made every day from the sale of land in the vicinity of a growing city by landowners who are not primarily commercial people, but may be farmers, or politicians, or lawyers, or country gentlemen. In my experience, these are the people who will invest a little money in a genuine risk enterprise if they have it to invest, partly, no doubt, from ignorant cupidity, and partly from a far-sighted and altruistic desire to help new industry come into being. In my experience, the latter motive is more common than the former, though they may be mixed. I believe that much of the early capital of Airspeed Limited came fundamentally from profit on the sale of land, though the money may have passed through several hands in its journey from the land to our company. Reflecting on these matters, it appears to me that money derived from land sold at a profit on the outskirts of a growing city is probably reinvested in the form of risk capital and development capital in the industries that make the city grow. To put the matter in a simplified and elemental form, the industries of an industrial city may have been capitalized in the past largely from the profit made out of the sale of the land on which the city stands. If this be true, any restriction on the sale of land for profit, which may be imposed by a government, will have the effect of cutting off the flow of risk capital and development capital from the industries of that country, and should be approached with the utmost caution. Right-thinking people of all parties will probably agree that it is unjust that the inheritor of a few fields should make a large fortune for doing no work. Yet, if that fortune is prevented from passing through the hands of that inheritor, it may well be that no new company will find the capital to start on in the early days of risk. The individual gambler is an essential feature in the provision of risk capital for industry. No organization can replace him, and without him, no new industry of any consequence can come to life. It's some very interesting political economic arguments here, which, to my mind, draw their main force and interest from being the observations of a person trying to get something done. And trying to identify his problems in getting it done. The first ferry. As you'll remember, this is the Airspeed Ferry, F-E-R-R-Y, a small passenger-carrying plane built for Sir Alan Cobham's National Aviation Day Limited, a sort of aerial circus, and the chief characteristic of which was that low takeoff speed was its, and short takeoffs, not long endurance. The first ferry was finished at the end of March and had to be transported to Sherburn in Elmet Aerodrome for flight trials. Its transport was a bit of a problem. To take it there in bits upon a truck and assemble it over there for flight would have meant weeks of very costly and inefficient work in somewhat primitive surroundings. We decided to tow it there along the road on its own wheels, less the extension planes. Being a three-engined machine, it had a span of 16 feet in this condition, which meant that it had to be moved in the middle of the night with a special police escort. We got as far as Tadcaster by 2 a.m. and met the rudder of the Berengaria coming the other way. That was sorted out, and we reached the aerodrome at dawn and began assembly and final inspection for flight. I had arranged for the very experienced pilot instructor of the flying club to do the test flying for us. I would have liked nothing better than to take it off myself, but my experience was inadequate, and the financial responsibility to the company too great. Worrell made the first flight a couple of days later, and found practically nothing wrong with the machine. It was about 5 miles an hour slower than we had estimated, but it flew and flew well. There were virtually no modifications needed as a result of the flight trials. It was, of course, a well-understood and a conservative design, as was essential to us, because we couldn't afford a failure or any long delay in getting through the trials. Cobham's display was already starting operations for the season, and it was essential to get the machine operating in the minimum of time. We put our case to the Air Ministry, and they helped us. All new type civil aircraft at that time had to be flight tested at Martlesham Heath before a certificate of airworthiness could be issued. The Air Ministry and the RAF pilots got behind the job, and the ferry passed through Martlesham in, I don't know if it's Martlesham, Martlesham, how do British people pronounce this word? And the ferry passed through Martlesham in 4 days without any trouble, and was operating with National Aviation Day Limited in the third week of April. In the first 3 months, the aircraft did 600 hours of flying and carried 36,000 paying passengers. It sounds as though the, Air Ministry was really interested in promoting aviation in those days. So far, so good. We had shown that we could do what we set out to do, but the overdraft had risen to £4,223. We set to work to complete the second ferry for Cobham and to build up 2 more machines for stock. That month, we instituted a premium bonus system in the shop. Full early, perhaps, in a concern that boasted only about 40 operatives, output went up, however. We engaged a typist and telephone girl who was a great help, a Miss Brunton. Some months later, When the work had grown to the point where no one girl could manage the telephone and the letters and the books, we started to work for another girl. We started to look for another girl. Miss Brunton asked if we would consider her sister, who could manage the telephone and do simple clerical work. She had been breeding dogs, but the dogs didn't pay. The second Miss Brunton came along and presented me with a problem. Rightly or wrongly, I had decreed that the girls were not to be called by their Christian names in the office. The new girl was no problem to my staff of shareholders, because from the first she was known as Dog Brunton. An unfortunate extension followed, and the office heard cries of, "Bitch! Where's Bitch? Oh, Bitch, when you've done Mr. Norway's letters, I've got some for you." Perhaps Ethel and Joan would have been better after all. The success of the ferry, following on the little success that we had had with the Tern sailplane, acted as a tonic to the company. The ferry was a sizable aircraft for those days, and other firms in the aircraft industry began to take note of our doings. Within the company, we began to make plans for establishing the concern on a more permanent basis. Clearly, if we were to go on building aeroplanes, we should have to move from the bus garage in York to some location on an aerodrome, and I began to visit various cities in England that had set up municipal aerodromes to ascertain what help they would give us if we were to move the company to their aerodrome. York was, unfortunately, rather backward at that time, and it was some years before an aerodrome came into being for the city. By May, the overdraft had risen to £5,303. Cobham was paying for his aircraft at the rate of £400 a week from the profits of National Aviation Day Limited, but these payments were swallowed up as soon as they came in by the ever-increasing costs of the company as we built up two more ferries as a speculation and proceeded with the design of the monoplane six-seater, soon to be christened the Courier. In the midst of his engagements all over the country with National Aviation Day Limited, Sir Alan Cobham was working up a novel project for those days, which would enable him to place an order with us for the new machine. This project was for the refueling of aeroplanes in flight. In general, the limitation to the load that an aeroplane can carry is set by its ability to get off the ground with a reasonable length of run at a sufficient rate of climb to clear the obstacles surrounding the aerodrome. Once off the ground and up at its cruising altitude, however, an aeroplane can normally carry a considerably greater load than it can take off the ground. Accordingly, if a bomber or a passenger aircraft could take on board most of its fuel in flight by transferring the liquid to it by a hose from another aeroplane, it could carry a greater load of passengers or bombs off the ground than would be the case if it had to take off with fuel for the whole journey. Of course, no airline operates with such procedure. And militaries rarely do either, partly because you need to have absolute confidence in your fueling method. You know, the short takeoff and landing version of the Lockheed Martin F-35 can't carry any weapons if it has to carry fuel, so the operational procedure that was evolved for it was to take off with a full load of weapons and almost no fuel and do immediate air-to-air refueling, which assumes that you have air superiority in the air over your short airfield or your jump jet carrier, which is not necessarily a safe assumption. You may be lifting off your fighters because you need them. Refueling of one aircraft from another had been carried out before this time in the case of small personal aeroplanes attempting long endurance records. The technique, in this case, had been to lower 2-gallon cans on the end of a rope from one aeroplane to the other. This was even done before the First World War. You can see some very old film of it. So Sir Alan now proposed a serious program of research and experiment into this matter, which would culminate in a non-stop flight from England to India in our airspeed courier, fueling in the air at 3 points on the way. For this purpose, he formed a new company, Flight Refueling Limited, which is still in existence as a great and powerful research concern. The late Lord Wakefield, who had made a fortune out of lubricating oils, was at that time a generous sponsor of all forms of aviation enterprise, and in the summer of 1932, Cobham was endeavoring to secure support from Lord Wakefield for Flight Refueling Limited, while he moved National Aviation Day Limited from town to town and piloted joyriders himself for much of the time. On my side, I was endeavoring to secure the order for the courier from Cobham. A great deal of this many-sided negotiation took place in fields in the surroundings of the air circus. At Lincoln and Liverpool, at Oxford and at Plymouth, I used to visit Cobham to correct the minor troubles of the ferries and to try to close the courier order. While a girl looped and spun a glider over the aerodrome, or a clown in a moth bombed a couple escaping to Gretna Green in a Model T Ford with rolls of toilet paper, Cobham would drink a cup of tea with me in his tent or caravan and discuss the teething troubles of the ferry or the courier order or the new location for the company. Gradually, I was eliminating all the towns but one, and by July our choice had fallen upon Portsmouth for the permanent establishment of the company. Portsmouth had everything to offer us. It had a new municipal aerodrome upon the outskirts of the town, immediately adjacent to good seaplane water in Langston Harbor. At that time, the flying boat was in the ascendant, and most of the services of Imperial Airways were about to turn to operation by flying boats. There was a proposal to develop Langstone Harbor as a great terminal flying boat base for services throughout the Commonwealth. Portsmouth was a town with a good reserve of engineering labor normally working in the dockyard. Moreover, Portsmouth was anxious to have us there. In July 1932, negotiations with Portsmouth were in quite an advanced state and justified a visit by Lord Grimthorpe to the Lord Mayor. This luncheon and the subsequent negotiations went off well, and we left the Guildhall and went to have tea in a small cafe while we waited for a train to London. Here my chairman raised a point with me which had been troubling him and which I think deserves a record. He had a general arrangement drawing of the courier, which we proposed to build, showing the retractable undercarriage. Already by that time he had a very serious financial commitment in the company, and quite prudently he had shown this drawing to a knowledgeable friend in the aircraft industry to get his opinion on it. This friend had shown the drawing to a great and famous designer. In the Battle of Britain, 8 years later, the brunt of the battle was borne by the Hawker Hurricane and the Supermarine Spitfire fighters, both, of course, with retractable undercarriages. The designer in question designed one of them, and wild horses will not drag from me which. In 1932, however, he held different views. The drawing came back from him with the message that the courier was a very good design and should fill a place in the commercial market and do well, provided that the designers would forget about the retractable undercarriage and fit a normal undercarriage to the machine. He, the designer, had been attracted by the retractable undercarriage at one time and had gone into it very carefully. It was no good. The device could not be made to work reliably, and if it could, it would be of little value in an aeroplane design. Over the teacups, in that shabby little cafe, Lord Grimthorpe presented this report to me. I had to think and talk quite hard. To think quite hard, because it was essential that so good a friend to the company should not lose his money by a technical error of our own. If we were wrong, and the great designer were right, he would probably do so. To talk quite hard, to convince my chairman of things that he already had vaguely in the back of his mind, that a policy of caution, of doing what everybody else was doing, could never bring us through to an established position in the industry. If we did only what the large conservative firms of the industry were capable of doing, we should inevitably lose to them, for, with their greater manufacturing capacity, they could sell for lower prices than our infant company could hope to manufacture for. Our only hope was to lead the way, to put out something technically ahead of them, and so monopolize the market till they had time to catch up. Lord Grimthorpe thought about it, and decided to allow us to go on with the retractable undercarriage. One of the things this book will do is sort of teach you what capitalism looks like when it's working successfully, which is an interesting problem, isn't it? The negotiations with the Portsmouth Corporation were brought to a satisfactory conclusion in July. I think the terms that they gave us deserve a record as a model of the sort of encouragement that can be given by an enterprising city to an infant industry. They would build us a factory building on the aerodrome to our own requirements, only stipulating that it should be capable of being used as a hangar if our company were to fail. This building, about 14,000 square feet in floor area, would cost about £4,000. The corporation wanted a down payment of £1,000 and the balance on hire purchase spread over 10 years with 5% interest on the outstanding loan. For the use of the aerodrome, we would pay a rent of 1% of our sales turnover up to a turnover of £60,000, 0.5% from £60,000 to £200,000, and 0.25% thereafter. In addition, there was a rental of, I think, £50 per acre for the land we occupied. These were very generous terms, which resulted in the establishment of a very considerable industry on Portsmouth Aerodrome. In August, the order for the courier was confirmed by Cobham, the move to Portsmouth was definitely decided on as soon as the factory could be built, and further bank guarantees were entered into by Lord Grimthorpe and Hewitt. An extra shareholding was taken up by Sir Alan Cobham. As the autumn drew on, I was chiefly occupied, I think, in progressing the design and construction of the factory at Portsmouth, and in trying to sell the two ferries we were building as a speculation. It was essential, of course, that we should keep on building something to retain our men, yet we had little capital to spare for locking up in stock, and no room for storing any completed aircraft. That autumn, as Cobham had forecast, some interest began to awaken in the formation of small private airlines in the British Isles. It came not from the private owners of aeroplanes, as we had thought it would, but from the bus operators. In England, the late Mr. Hillman was beginning to consider an airline to Paris from his elementary aerodrome at Romford, and in Scotland, Mr. John Sword was making plans for a network of lines joining up Glasgow with Belfast, Edinburgh, Inverness, and the Western Islands. I visited Mr. Sword several times and found him a hard-headed businessman, but generous and helpful personally. He had worked up from a modest start after the First War to a wealthy and powerful position in the motor bus world in Scotland. Like many such men, he was expert in getting value for his money. He was, however, keenly interested in Airspeed Limited and very sympathetic to the company. Having trod the hard way upwards himself so recently, he could understand our many difficulties. He bought the third ferry that autumn and incorporated it in the name of his new company, Midland and Scottish Air Ferries Limited. We made no progress with Mr. Hillman for a reason which caused us a great deal of concern. De Havillands were after him. Up till that time, the small commercial machine had not attracted this company very much. They had built small machines for the private owner in great numbers, and they had built large machines for Imperial Airways. When we had bought engines from them for the ferries, they had indicated verbally to us that they were not very likely to compete with us. However, necessity knows no law. The continuing depression was playing havoc with the sales of aeroplanes for the private owner, and we were pointing the way to a new market. Early in 1933, De Havillands produced the twin-engine Dragon to the order of Mr. Hillman, a machine that was a good deal faster than the ferry and a good deal cheaper, though not, perhaps, quite so safe. And this goes back to his remark earlier that you have your choice of making the machine perform better or of having a lower takeoff speed, and nobody ever chooses the lower takeoff speed, except that the ferry was built for Sir Alan Cobham, who needed short field takeoff. In the design of aircraft, a designer studies and analyzes the machines that are already flying, and then goes one better. The Dragon was produced a year later than the ferry, and was a better aircraft for the job, and was sold for a price which in our smaller works we could not hope to equal. From the day the Dragon appeared, we had little hope of selling ferries. We sold the fourth ferry quite unexpectedly one day to Mr. Sword, who had expertly concealed the fact that he wanted another. He made us take his 6.5-liter Bentley in for £700 as part of the price of the fourth ferry. In his first affluence, he had bought a fleet of 7 very expensive motor cars, but he was now coming to the view that a wise man could do with rather fewer vehicles. I drove this magnificent thing from Ayr to London to sell it, the best car that I have ever driven or am ever likely to drive, but in the Depression there was no sale for a car like that, and we could not afford to keep it till the times improved. I think we only got about £400 for it. Even at that price, we could none of us afford to buy it in for our own use. The advent of the Dragon raised a point of policy, which was to trouble us throughout the life of the company till Air Ministry orders were to swamp and obliterate commercial work. We were using de Havilland engines in the ferry, and were therefore buying engines from our competitors in the same market. However friendly to that company we might be, and our relations with de Havilland's were very good throughout, there were obvious commercial dangers in using their engines. We were far too small to think of manufacturing engines for ourselves, besides being inexperienced in such a business, and we began to shape our developments to use, if possible, engines manufactured by an organization that did not make aeroplanes. In the British aircraft industry at that time, such engines were not very easy to find. Lord Nuffield, however, was turning his attention to aero engines, and Wolseley Motors had produced a very attractive little radial engine of about 200 horsepower, which was technically very promising. From that time onwards, we began to shape our design policies around the Wolseley engine wherever possible, and as time went on, we were to get a good deal of cooperation from that company. Their engines, however, in the winter of 1932-33, were in an early stage of development. The company's accounts for the first year of working showed a loss, the first of many. I forget the amount of this loss, but I know that it was reached after capitalizing everything that could possibly be capitalized in the accounts, so that the true position of the company was a good deal worse than the stated loss. The result was no surprise to anybody. On the other side was the considerable degree of technical success that had already been achieved. I do not remember that anybody was particularly depressed, though by the end of the year 1932, the position of the company was serious. The issued share capital by that time was £11,800, and the overdraft about £6,000. For the first time we were getting behind in paying the monthly trade invoices. It must have been about this time that I began to defer paying our own monthly salaries, too, a default that was to occur a number of times within the next 2 years. It did not seem to me quite fair to defer paying our bills for materials, and yet to take our salaries in full on the first of each month. If any creditor turned nasty and threatened us with a writ, it would add strength to the position if one could say, "Look, old boy, I'm in this as well as you. If we go into liquidation, you and I are both in the same boat. We're both creditors." And then one could follow up with a story about the businessman in the West Riding, who went in to see his bank manager about the overdraft, and asked the manager if he had ever been in the wool trade. The bank manager said, "No." The man said, "Well, you're in it now," and walked out. Our trade creditors were soon to find themselves involuntarily in the position of debenture holders, and I must say that they were all extraordinarily good about it. In this, of course, they were influenced by the good technical reputation that we were building up. That winter, we built a small monoplane two-seater designed by W.S. Shackleton and Lee Murray, both firm friends of mine still, though, rather surprisingly, in view of the disputes that we had over what constituted good workmanship. I had taken this job on at a fixed price, and in view of the financial situation of the company, I well remember the grief and mental anguish that I went through when they called on us to remake a thoroughly bad piece of cowling. The machine was low-powered and slow, but very delightful to fly in, for it was a parasol monoplane with the pusher engine in the center section. The fuselage was very low on the ground, and the pilot and passenger were out in front, ahead of the engine, and the wing, with a perfect view. Only one machine was ever built, for it came out at a time when the private owner market was dying in England, but it was a good design for club use. Oh, God, and now I'm remembering a photograph I saw of, I think it was the U.S. Navy's first float plane, anyway, which was a pusher aircraft where the propeller was in the middle of the fuselage about halfway back. In other words, there was just a section of the fuselage which had blades sticking out of it and rotated. And then, of course, the fuselage before and aft of that was all stationary. Hideous design. Where was I? In March 1933, we moved the company from York to Portsmouth into the new factory built for us by the Portsmouth Corporation. By that time, we had over 100 men employed in the bus garage in York, but of these, I think only about 50 elected to make the move south with us. Some of the others were to join us again later on, for we were to find that the Portsmouth area was attractive to labor. As spring came on, men working in the grey industrial towns of the Midlands and the North would begin to think about the sunshine and the seaside, and would take the opportunity of moving down to a job with us, thinking that they would go back north in the autumn. When autumn came, they usually stayed on. The transfer of the company to Portsmouth was probably a wise move on these grounds alone. It enabled our struggling company to get a good staff together more quickly than otherwise we could have done. And I will remark that in the years of the Depression, having to spend less money on heating fuel was probably an advantage that didn't escape the laborers. For the first time, in Portsmouth, we were all under one roof, a tremendous help to Tiltman and the design office. We had nearly three times the area to work in, with the aerodrome immediately outside the door, giving promise of lower costs and more effective work. The first courier for Cobham was practically complete when we left York, and only the final erection and inspection before flight remained to be done in the new factory. This was the first retractable undercarriage machine to be produced in England for many years, and in the test flying, therefore, we should be breaking new ground. There were, of course, no proprietary hydraulic components already on the market that we could make use of. Tiltman and his drawing office had had to design the manual hydraulic pump and the jacks and the changeover cocks and the indicator lights entirely from first principles, with little expert help, because the design was a new conception. It was inevitable that teething troubles would occur, sometimes in flight, and this would mean that the pilot might well find that he could not lower his undercarriage. To meet this point, the design was arranged to retract the undercarriage legs completely, but to leave half the diameter of the wheels exposed below the undersurface of the wing. In this position, the axles were up against a firm abutment, and a belly landing could be made upon the wheels with little damage to the aircraft. In fact, a belly landing on the courier only involved a bent metal propeller and minor damage to fairings, and was normally put right for a repair cost of about £20. See? Now you know. If you've ever wondered why photographs of early retractable undercarriage airplanes show the wheels sticking out the bottom, now you know. The choice of a test pilot for the first flights of the courier was a serious responsibility, complicated by the financial situation of the company. In the first flight trials, trouble with the undercarriage was quite likely to arise, and if that happened, a first-class pilot would be required to use all his experience and skill if the aircraft were to be landed safely. But we had little money to pay the fees of a first-class consultant pilot, nor had we any great confidence in the civilian pilots who were available. In these circumstances, we made contact with Flight Lieutenant G.H. Stanforth. George Stanforth. It's A-I-N, and I don't know if that's pronounced A or An. George Stanforth was a serving officer in the RAF, employed at that time as a test pilot in the Royal Aircraft Establishment at Farnborough. He was one of the best test pilots in the country. He had been a member of the Schneider Cup team and held the world's speed record for seaplanes in the Supermarine S-6. George Stanforth was keenly interested in the Courier and wanted to fly it, and I think his superiors in the Royal Air Force wanted him to fly it too, for they made no objection when he requested permission to carry out this test flying for us while he was on leave. Married flight lieutenants in the RAF are not particularly affluent as a class, and George was glad to do the job for us for the pitifully small fee that I could offer him. On our part, we could have got no better man. I have found that it is difficult, if not impossible, to generalize about the mentality of a good test pilot. George Stanforth was a fine character, a big humorous man, generous to the point of having little sense of money, so that he seemed to be in the habit of giving any that came into his hands to his wife, lest he should spend it too quickly. When standing a round of beers at the bar, he would ask his wife for 5 shillings and give her back the change. On the ground, he was mentally slow to grasp a technical point, but he had immense tenacity and would never leave a technical matter till he had mastered it in every detail. Before the test flights of the Courier, we had the machine supported on trestles and jacks in the hangar, in the flying attitude, so that the pilot could get the feel of the machine before he left the ground. The open hangar doors in front of the aircraft permitted a full view of the aerodrome, and the undercarriage could be raised and lowered as in flight. In our innocence, we had supposed that an hour in the machine in this condition would be sufficient for the pilot, for the Courier was not a very complicated aeroplane, but it was not so. George Stanforth sat in the machine in this condition for 5 solid hours, all through one working day, with Tom Lang or the chief inspector at his side asking and re-asking the same questions and receiving the same explanations, or just sitting, feeling the controls, and staring at the aerodrome in an apparent daydream. I think his one deficiency was that he was not a very quick pupil, and I think that he was very well aware of it, so that he required this prolonged study before he could feel that he really knew the aircraft to the extent that he would not have to stop and think in an emergency. And that right there, of course, is the key. When you're a pilot in the air, you often have to do things without any time to think about them. You have to be able to react correctly without having to choose what the correct reaction is. Oh. Kuma has been kind enough to drop in a link in Calm to some photos of these kinds of airplanes. Airplanes of Airspeed Limited. I'm going to have a look at that link. That looks very interesting. There's a picture of the Airspeed Ferry. Funny looking little machine. In the air, he was masterly, of course. So far as I remember, he did about 5 hours flying on the machine, establishing preliminary performance figures which were practically identical with those established later in the official trials. The undercarriage gave no trouble in these early trials, but he had to cope with an emergency of another sort. Taking off into an easterly wind from Portsmouth Aerodrome, the mud flats and tidal water of Langston Harbor lie immediately beyond the confines of the aerodrome, with no possibility of landing undamaged. George Stanforth suffered a complete engine failure at an altitude of about 300 feet just after taking off in this direction, due, I think, to a defect in the petrol system. The machine was climbing steeply, with the undercarriage already up, when this happened, and I have never seen an aircraft handled so expertly. Within an instant, the machine was 45 degrees nose down to keep up speed, and turning, while the undercarriage came out in record time. Then she flattened out, neither too high nor too low, and landed neatly and perfectly back into the aerodrome downwind. In the hands of a lesser pilot, the machine might well have been lost. Perhaps the long, wearisome hours spent in the cockpit in the hangar had paid off. George Stanforth was killed in the Second World War, flying a Spitfire in the Western Desert, a great loss to the RAF and to his country. The Courier went to Martlesham for trials, which were extended because this first machine to have a practical and a reliable retracting undercarriage was to exercise a considerable influence on the design of military aircraft. The only reason why I say that I think the designer to which Lord Grimthorpe referred the design of the Courier, who had a negative opinion of the retractable undercarriage, might have been more likely the designer of the Hurricane than the designer of the Spitfire, is purely that Supermarine were mostly in the business of seaplanes originally, floatplanes. And of course, floatplanes with retractable undercarriages do exist, but they are uncommon.
Rang, Mama, rang. Where did you go? Rang, Mama, rang.
The Air Ministry got all the leading aircraft designers in the country down to Martlesham while the machine was in their hands, presumably to rub their noses in it. At Portsmouth, we were completing the last ferry for Mr. John Sword and commencing the production of a batch of 6 couriers, but the finances were again in a serious condition. By the middle of May, the guaranteed overdraft was £8,450, and there was an unsecured overdraft above this limit, making the total debt to the bank well over £10,000. We also owed about £1,700 in the form of trade-in... We also owed about £1,700 in the form of trade invoices, some of them going back to January. In spite of our considerable technical successes, a cautious man might well have hesitated to support such an unfinancial company further. Yet, in the middle of May, Lord Grimthorpe turned up unasked with a check for £1,000 to take up 1,000 more shares. In spite of the financial picture, the prospects of the company were encouraging, because when the official performance figures came through, the Courier was seen to be a technical success. With an Armstrong Siddeley Lynx engine of 240 horsepower, the machine had a maximum speed at sea level of 163 miles per hour, about 8 miles an hour faster than our forecast, when carrying a pilot, 5 passengers, and 3.5 hours fuel. About 20 miles per hour of this speed was probably due to the retraction of the undercarriage. In its day, this was an outstanding performance, and the prospective orders for the machine were promising, a promise tempered by the fact that most of the small airlines that were then coming into being had little or no money. By the end of August, the overdraft had risen to £12,847, over £4,000 of which was unsecured, and the bank manager was getting very unpleasant. Trade creditors, too, were showing signs that their forbearance was near its end. In these circumstances, Lord Grimthorpe came forward again with a personal bank guarantee of a further £5,200, and by this act produced a situation amongst our working shareholders which deserves a record. These shareholders got together in the office, without consulting either Tiltman or myself, to debate the financial situation of the company, which employed them on their trivial salaries. Most of them had access to a little more money, and they came forward after consultation between themselves, with a proposal to support the company further to the extent of £12,000 between them, in the form of 6% debentures or bank guarantees. This offer from officials of the company who were not members of the board was generous and a great encouragement to the directors, for these men, led by Tom Lang, knew all the seamy side of the business and could not be deceived about its prospects. Accordingly, the company took powers to issue the debentures, and with this encouragement went cracking on. As I've said, this is the exact opposite of the situation of modern startups, where people are giving up salaries and hoping to be paid in shares, which will appreciate greatly. By the beginning of September, we had delivered the first production courier as a demonstrator, paid for, to the Aircraft Exchange and Mart Limited, to whom we had given the selling agency for the British Isles, and the machine had already made a very fast return flight between London and Edinburgh to demonstrate the possibilities of internal airlines. We must have paid a lot of invoices, because debtors and creditors were about equal at £3,000. Having got the financial situation more or less under control, a prudent board might well have hesitated before a further expansion. But both board and shareholders were of one mind. The company must get big, quickly, or it must inevitably perish. It was resolved at the beginning of September to double the floor area of the factory, making the best hire purchase deal we could with the corporation, to lay down couriers in batches of not less than six, and to press ahead with the design of a new twin-engine machine based upon the courier. This new machine was the result of sales experience. In the provision of aircraft for the little airlines that were coming into being, our chief competitors, as always, were our old friends, the de Havilland Company. Their Dragon and Dragon Rapide machines were slower than the Courier, and, I think, less economical in operation by virtue of the high performance of our aircraft, but they had twin-engine reliability to offer, as well as low price and a first-class servicing organization. Price we could argue about, because all speed costs money, and we were making every effort to provide a first-class service for our aircraft, but already the single-engine aeroplane was becoming out of date for airline use. Already, legislation was in sight to restrain operators from flying passengers over sea routes in single-engine aeroplanes. We therefore set ourselves to consider whether we could not develop a twin-engined version of the Courier using the extension planes and many of the other components of the single-engine machine to lower the development costs of the new aircraft, later to be christened the Envoy. We specified Wolseley AR-9 engines for this machine, a very promising new engine of modern design backed by all the resources of the Nuffield organization. That autumn, Sir Alan Cobham was hard at work on his refueling experiments. Using one of the old Handley Page W-10 biplanes from National Aviation Day Limited as a tanker. Squadron leader W. Helmore was normally his co-pilot on these flights, and was to go with him on the projected flight to India, but on one or two occasions I flew with Cobham upon these experiments. The Courier was provided with a hatch in the top of the fuselage, which the co-pilot could open in flight and stand up in, his body above the waist exposed to the airstream at about 90 miles per hour. A hose was then let down from the tanker, flying 100 feet above the Courier, to pass the fuel. The chief difficulty lay in making the first contact between the machines. The hose could not be lowered at once, for it waved frantically and could have whipped the tail off the Courier if it had hit it. The first method tried was to lower a little bag of sand on the end of a light cod line. Cobham would fly the Courier so that Helmore or myself could reach out and catch the line. The cod line was then pulled into the Courier, pulling down a heavier rope, and finally the hose was pulled down, the nozzle poked into an appropriate funnel leading to the Courier's petrol system, and the juice was turned on. All this demanded very accurate formation flying by Cobham, impossible in bumpy weather, but it worked fairly well, till one day the little bag of sand jammed between the aileron and the wing of the Courier, and put the machine out of control, and gave Cobham and Helmore a great fright. After that, they used a child's toy balloon filled with water as the weight, which would burst if anything of the sort happened again, and it was on the basis of this system that they set out for India early the following year. I shall always remember standing up, half out of the courier, trying to catch this thing as we flew in formation below the Handley Page, and how frightened I was. My respect for Air Commodore Helmore has not diminished with the passing of the years. Now, of course, a totally different system has been developed by Cobham's organization for the refueling of aeroplanes in flight. I've always loved the old RAF ranks. Air Commodore! You know, your steampunk folks must love that. These courier refueling flights were valuable to us, because all aeroplanes have initial teething troubles to be rectified by modifications to the design, and with the first courier operating in Cobham's hands upon short local flights in this way, we were able to get through this stage of the development with a minimum of trouble. This was not the least of the many benefits that Airspeed owed to Sir Alan. That autumn, two of our £5-per-week working shareholders, Lord Ronald Shea and R.D. King, formed a small selling company to take the agency for Airspeed and other products in India and Burma. They bought a courier as a demonstrator with a more powerful engine to improve the takeoff of the machine in tropical conditions, an Armstrong Siddeley Cheetah Mark V of about 300 horsepower, and Ronald Shea flew this out to India to set up a sales organization for us in New Delhi while King remained on as our sales manager. In England, the Aircraft Exchange and Mart had produced a number of dubious orders for couriers, most of which were from optimistic, newly created airlines with little money who required a higher purchase deal. In the end, most of the aircraft that we sold upon these terms found their way to the war, which was to break out 2.5 years later in Spain. The second annual general meeting of the company was held in December 1933, and a further loss was announced. This produced no crisis, because the meeting was held in my office, in the works at Portsmouth, and was attended only by the directors and officials who were working in the company. There were still very few other shareholders. The Air Ministry had just ordered a courier for experiments with the retractable undercarriage, an earnest of better things to come. The new factory extension was well underway by grace of the Portsmouth Corporation, but already we were talking of another one. 12 couriers and 6 envoys were under construction at the end of the year. During that winter, both Tiltman and I were elected fellows of the Royal Aeronautical Society. This is the highest technical distinction that British aviation has to offer, and we got it, I think, primarily for the production of the Courier, with its retractable undercarriage, though in my case, my work upon the R-100 had something to do with it as well. The company, too, was marching on to technical distinction. At that time, the firms composing the British aircraft manufacturing industry were grouped in a very tight organization, the Society of British Aircraft Constructors. After the First War, when government orders were few and most aircraft firms were running at a loss, an agreement had been reached between the government and this trade society that, in consideration of the firms remaining in being, when bulk orders came to be placed again, no orders would be given to newly created firms until the firms in the existing industry were full to capacity with work. This was a reasonable agreement in 1923 when it was made, but 10 years later it bore hardly upon us. For years we were to see less competent firms receiving bulk government orders while we struggled on upon the edge of liquidation. The Society was conscious of this position and were not unfriendly to us. First, they made us associate members and permitted us to show the Courier at their annual display in 1933, and after several years we broke into their ring and became full members of the Society. About this time, we engaged our first regular full-time test pilot. Previously, we had made do with whatever pilots we could find at the time we wanted a machine flown. Now, however, the work had grown to a point when a full-time pilot was justified. We could not pay more than a poor salary, however, and we were lucky to get so good a man for our £400 a year. When delivering the second ferry to John's Sword at Inverness 6 months previously, I had met Flight Lieutenant C.H.A. Coleman, a retired young RAF-trained officer who was joyriding for John's Sword with a Fox Moth. Coleman was a merry, apparently irresponsible young man, and I would have classed him with 100 other light-hearted vendors of aeroplanes, but for one thing. He was flying his little airplane out of a pasture field, and before taking off, I saw him deliberately pace out the distance to the far hedge to make quite sure he had enough room to get off. I questioned him about the distance and found he had a very clear and accurate idea of the room that he required to get off safely, with varying conditions of load and wind and height of obstacles. In these days, this approach may seem elementary, but it showed an attitude of mind that was by no means common amongst ex-RAF pilots in 1933. When he applied for a job with us, it seemed to me that our airplanes would be safe in his hands, and I was not disappointed. He was killed in 1941 over northern France, flying a Beaufighter fighter. Well, you've been listening to Hear Now the Words on and on radio, which is a service of the SDF Public Access Unix System. Send those cards and letters to Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101, United States of America. If you'd like to support these broadcasts, paypal.me/PrometheusLives, patreon.com